Thank you for joining us for the first of the Taiwan UK Critical Sport Network podcast series. I have with me today two of the leading figures in the field who, for many, will actually need no introduction at all. First, we have Professor Alan Berner of Loughborough University. Alan is Professor of Sport and Social Theory, and he's written extensively about sport and nationalism, including in the Asia-Pacific region. Hello, Alan.
Morning, Dom.
And also, I have with me Professor Sean Chen of National Taiwan Sport University. Sean has been a leading scholar of sport in Taiwan for a number of years and is the Deputy Secretary of the Taiwan Society for Sociology of Sport, a member of the IWSA Advisory Board, and founder of the Left Field Facebook group. Hello, Sean.
Hello, Dom. Hello, Alan.
Hi, Sean.
Great that you could both join us today. The purpose of what we're going to do in today's podcast is really to introduce listeners to some of the key organisational dynamics and social processes which influence sport in both the UK and Taiwan. What we aim to do by looking at comparatively at sport in these two settings and these two contexts is to illustrate how researchers in the two countries could work together in future, how we might build future research projects and work collaboratively. So the idea really is to sketch a broad picture of the terrain of sport in the two countries as sociologists have understood it. So I'm going to start with Alan and the organisation of sport in the UK. What do you think is distinctive about the organisation of sport in the UK?
The organisation of sport in the UK isn't, I guess, completely unique, but it's very different from most places, even most places that are multinational states. Given the primacy of sport, modern sport in what is the UK, but particularly in England, we had a situation where sporting organisations came into existence before any global governing bodies existed. And of course, the first organised sports teams representing parts of the United Kingdom were English. So in the Football Association in England, the Rugby Football Union. Now, of course, once you've got a team representing a nation, you've got to play against somebody. And they played against Scotland first, then Ireland, then Wales. Now, of course, that situation persists, but we also have running alongside it British sporting organisations such as UK Sport and the British Olympic Association. So there's an interesting creative tension, I think, that goes on between these national, in the sense of UK-wide organisations, and the very separate ones which represent each component part of the United Kingdom, or in the case of Ireland, going beyond that to these islands to include the whole of Ireland. And I think that's pretty unusual, because in other multinational states, such as Spain, for example, there is no separate national representation for places like the Basque region or for Catalonia.
Thanks, Alan. And I guess great time for Sean to come in here. I guess the organisation of sport in Taiwan is quite distinct compared with that.
Oh, yeah, it's very, very different. I think based on my research, I think there are Department of Digital Culture, Media and Sport, and also UK Sport, two distinctive organizations in the UK, let alone plenty of professional leagues running the show. There's one single top official sport organization in Taiwan. Its full name is Sport Administration. Yeah, it's obvious, which is placed under Ministry of Education. As the name can tell, it is a very PE-minded organization. Not only that, there are plenty for them to supervise. And however, it is interesting that the Director General is still vacant after some controversies happening during the Tokyo Olympics. There are six divisions, including Sports Facility Division, International and Cross-Strait Sport Division, Competitive Athlete Division, Sports for All Division, and School PE Division, and the Sports Industry and Planning Division. So as you can see, they basically control and run everything as long as it's related to sport. So also there are over 60 sports federations overseeing their respective sports and being the liaison to their corresponding international federations. There are only two sports with mature professional leagues. They are baseball and basketball. However, there are only five teams in the professional baseball league. So I remember Alan asked me, what? Only five teams can call themselves a league? Yeah, that's a harsh reality of the professional sports here. By the way, it's also called Chinese Professional Baseball League. I know it's very confusing, so that I'm reluctant to bring it up. We've also got two professional basketball leagues. One is only 1 year old, called themselves PLG, and the other one is a challenger, which will launch this year, called themselves T1 League. As for football, we've only got one semi-pro league at top in men's and women's league. They heavily rely on the subsidies by the Taiwanese FA and Sport Administration. So there is huge difference between two countries in terms of sport organizations. It's mostly a top-down system here in Taiwan instead of a maybe more tradition bottom-up ecosystem in the UK.
Yeah, I think that's a really good comparison. And one of the things that struck me when you were speaking was about the role of the Ministry of Education and the PE focus.
Yeah.
It seems to me, Alan, you might want to comment on this, that the UK is very different both in terms of that government structure, but also in terms of the place of education within the Department of Culture, Media and Sport.
Yeah, and it's always been an issue, not just for the UK government or governance of sport, but for the various component parts as well, as to where sport actually goes and how significant sport is. A number of years ago, a PhD student of mine did work on the role of the Minister of Sport, who isn't really a minister, doesn't always sit in the cabinet, although his or her boss might do so. And the fact is that they don't have a very significant role to play. I mean, I think UK sport, the Olympic authorities, and then the governing bodies are probably more important in sport. Is kind of relegated, and where PE comes in, of course, it's much more likely to relate to the Ministry of Education and also to the Ministry of Health in terms of the benefits of physical activity. It's all fairly messy, doesn't have quite that same clear structure that Sean has talked about with reference to Taiwan.
Yes, I think that's one of the things that has held UK sport policy back in recent years, is that there isn't this kind of coordinated head. Sean, it struck me that, looking back on the UK context, and you think about how these sports organisations seem to have been around forever, it seems very organic that they're there, but you're in a context where these sports organisations are all very new. Can you say something about the kind of motivation for why these sports organizations are developing now? And what do people hope for?
Yeah, some of them are new, especially the professional ones. But you can actually trace most of them back way back into the KMT dictatorship era. So most of them inherited the kind of a totalitarian governance mentality in the first few decades, like in the 60s and 70s. But now, after the end of martial law, I think we are getting there. In terms of getting citizens involved. And so it's very odd that we have a new basketball coming up, considering all the pandemic scenario. Mm-hmm. That means that people are starting to realize the potential and maybe bright side of the sport as a business. So I think we are still learning. We are still learning, that's for sure. But there are a lot of, baggages from the past for them. We have to get rid of them first.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you. I want to move on next to the role of sport in the creation of identities within the two contexts. I think probably we could start with Taiwan. What role does sport contribute in reproducing how people identify?
Yeah, Taiwan has been a very homogeneous country with only 1% of the population is categorized as a new immigrants, or we here call them new Taiwanese. Among the minorities, indigenous Taiwanese actually play a huge role in the sport of Taiwan. From the anthropology perspective, they are a part of larger Austronesian peoples. Despite of being only less than 2.5% of the population, they certainly are overrepresented in sports scenes. Of the 68 member Taiwanese squad in the Tokyo Olympics, 13 of them were indigenous Taiwanese, which is 19%. Indigenous baseball players constantly comprise of 30 to 40% of the players registered in the professional leagues. Other than that, there are two major ethnic groups in Taiwanese population. The majority is called Benshenren or Islanders, meaning the people from within the province. The other one is called Waishenren or Mainlanders, meaning the people out of the province. There is a simple way to dichotomize these two. The Islanders are economic immigrants whose ancestors immigrated from Southeast China to Taiwan in the late 19th century to early 20th century. The Mainlanders are political immigrants who came to Taiwan with Chiang Kai-shek after the defeat in Chinese Civil War in 1949. Based on the line, there was a clear distinction in the 60s and 70s between the two groups. There is a saying, Islanders play baseball and Mainlanders play basketball. The line gradually blurs as the Taiwanese society is getting more diversified. The Mainlanders being the minority and the newly immigrants, as you can foresee, will be less and less in the overall population. However, the Mainlanders of the older generation still in the higher position in the basketball administration and being the executives, while the Islanders dominate baseball organizations. So far, the so-called new Taiwanese, mainly immigrated from Southeast Asian countries like Vietnam, Indonesia, Philippines, and China, are not that prominent in sports field in Taiwan. However, there is an NGO called Taiwan Immigrants Football League. They organize weekend football competition for the newly immigrants.
That seems like a really complex and varied picture.
Yeah,
let's hear about the UK first, and then we'll maybe come back and probe some of those issues. Alan, talk to us a little bit about how sport creates identities in the UK.
Well, I think this is also complicated, but the UK is not just multinational, but it's certainly multicultural, so probably less homogeneous in that sense than Taiwan. The crucial thing, so in terms of identity formation, I think, is the fact that the national component parts of the United Kingdom, England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, I can leave to one side for the moment because it does raise different issues. But these three are all recognisably different nations. And certainly Wales and Scotland and people in these countries would regard themselves as being very different. For the English, often there's an elision between what it means to be English and what it means to be British. The fact is, though, that they do have separate civil societies. In the case of Scotland, it's particularly marked. So 1707, the Act of Union, really the foundation for what is now the United Kingdom. But Scotland retained its own established church, the Church of Scotland, so different from Wales and Ireland in that regard, as well as England, a separate education system and a separate legal system. Now, most Scots are aware of these things, but really they're not highly visible on a day-to-day basis. I mean, you don't really know that there's such a thing as a procurator fiscal in the Scottish legal system unless you happen to fall foul of the law. What does make you constantly remember that you are from Scotland or indeed from England, Wales, or the two parts of Ireland is the existence of these separate sports organisations. And I think these have kept alive a sense of identity. Had it been a situation where modern sport was invented, if you like, before the formation of the United Kingdom, then there would be no distinction. Everything would be run as our Olympic team is run. It would be all about football GB, rugby GB, and so on. But it isn't like that. And so to that extent, the continued presence of national teams represented in international global competitions is, I think, very significant for people to actually realize that they are different. And I think people are generally very conscious of this. And I notice with students that English students nowadays are more likely to describe themselves as English as opposed to British. So I think even in England, there's been that growing awareness of the separate identities, and sport plays a part, but I would also say the pandemic's played a part. I mean, today we're back to wearing masks in shops and public transport in England, but in the rest of the United Kingdom, people never stopped being told to wear masks in these settings. So things like that on a daily basis remind us of difference. And of course, things like qualification for the World Cup in football, the future of the Rugby World Cup and so on are also constant reminders. And they are, I think, for many people, I won't say everyone, because of course there's people in all these multinational units that don't even like sport, or they like certain sports, but not all sports. But in general, sport is probably the most visible element in what distinguishes the various component parts in terms of helping to produce identities and reproduce these identities.
Thanks, Alan. I mean, it reminds me of the comments we had earlier about the different level of centralization, perhaps, of sport. In Taiwan, you have a very centralized system, and in the UK, a very diffuse system. I'm conscious that we're going to talk about gender in a subsequent podcast, so I don't want to say too much about that here. So I'm going to ask a follow-up question around class and ethnicity. Sean, I kind of got the impression that in Taiwan, ethnicity and class were quite closely tied together. And I'm thinking that in the UK, we have sports which are distinctly class-based. So, Sean, am I right in that impression about Taiwan and the class-ethnicity crossover?
Yeah, it's very complicated. The reason why Indigenous people, they so well represented in sports scenes, that's also because they are mostly from, you know, lower social eco status families. That's one of their shot to have an upward mobility in the society. So of course it's related, but it's not necessarily so applicable to all the athletes here. I think unlike UK, Taiwan is a more, we kind of maybe under the Confucianism that we kind of believe that we can control our own destiny instead of, you know, being so influenced by which family you are born. So I guess that's part of a reason it's not that well connected to social class here in Taiwan. But generally speaking, athletes here in Taiwan, they are not, you know, that much respected, except for that when they win the Olympic medals. That's probably one of the few exceptions when they really got positive publicities.
Yeah, so it's only the really high flyers, the ones who are achieving success for the nation, that are really well respected. Whereas I think possibly in the UK, it's different. But Alan, can you say something about the kind of class ethnicity link or perhaps separation in the UK?
Well, I mean, certainly class has always been a significant factor from the origins of modern sport in England and the location of some of these in the private or what we call public schools, but the old traditional boys boarding schools. It's become more complicated, I think. And ethnicity is a factor in this. I mean, obviously, from the end of the Second World War onwards, British society became far more diverse. And we've seen, for example, in English football and the success recently of the English national football team, how many players of African Caribbean origin actually represent that team. Some of them mixed race, some of them not. That's not so noticeable, for example, in Scotland, Wales, or Northern Ireland, where there isn't the same concentration of an African Caribbean heritage population. Cricket, of course, and cricket in England is going through all kinds of agonies at the moment because of the issue of ethnicity. And part of that is, I think, and I don't know whether it's racism as such or some of it's Islamophobia rather than simply targeted at people because of their race or the color of their skin. But we have got these accusations of racist discrimination towards players of South Asian heritage. And in both sports, there are the additional problems that we see very few Black coaches, Black managers of teams in football. And again, the administration of sports in England, especially cricket, has tended to be white, male, and middle class. So you've got a multicultural society, a diverse population, particularly in England, but that's not filtered through yet, except on the field of play, to the organization and administration of sport.
Okay. Thanks very much for that, Alan. I'm going to move on because I'm conscious of time. And I want to focus a bit more on national sports. I think first it might be useful to define what we mean by national sports. And Alan, I'd like you to do that, if I may. And then Sean, we'll come to you and perhaps you could tell us about which the national sports of Taiwan were. So Alan, firstly, what is a national sport?
Well, one of the problems with national sports is that certainly in the UK, we don't have any national sports that are de jure. That's to say they are designated as national sports by legislation. So, for example, a country like Canada has two de jure national sports. Ice hockey, the obvious one, but lacrosse perhaps being the less obvious one. So in a sense, in the UK, we're always just trying to guess what the national sports are based on the popularity of these sports, the relative success in those sports at different times, the history of the sports, and a variety of other factors. And I would say, and I'm going to say this even about Wales and Northern Ireland, that the most popular sport in the United Kingdom for men and women is football. However, that doesn't manifest itself necessarily in terms of how people perceive their national sports to be. Now, I imagine for women in England, for example, netball might be seen as more significant than football. In Wales, rugby union would probably be seen by many as the national sport, although I'm not sure that more people play rugby than football in Wales. In Scotland, historically, the national sport was probably football. It was certainly the one that attracted most attention, most media attention, and probably still does because of the existence of two major significant teams in Glasgow, Celtic and Rangers. There's an argument in Scotland that we actually have to forget about that and look back to other things. So last week, the European Championships, gold medals in curling, bowls on ice, if you like, both won by Scottish teams. And interestingly, teams representing Scotland. So not like the Olympic team, where it's nearly always Scottish curlers, but they represent the UK. Curling has always traditionally been played in Scotland. There are very few players outside Scotland. Shinty, a stick and ball game, another Scottish one. And the one that I've made the strongest case for in the past is golf. Now, I don't know whether golf was really invented in Scotland or not, or whether Mary, Queen of Scots, played it in the years gone by. But what is certain is that visitors to Scotland will be struck by the number of golf courses. And these golf courses, which are very intimately connected with the Scottish landscape. So that's why we have these debates then about what are the de facto national sports, in fact national sports, as opposed to the de jure. It'd be interesting to see what would happen if we ever saw a time when legislation was introduced to actually nominate a national sport for each part of the multinational United Kingdom.
Yeah, I think that would probably seal the fracturing of the United Kingdom into its separate parts, perhaps. Sean, national sports in Taiwan, is there designated national sports? Is there a conflict between popularity and social significance?
Of course, it's not officially or legally designated as a national sport, but obviously it's baseball. Yeah, and ever since its colonial time by Japanese, baseball has been the sport for the island. In 1931, a Taiwanese high school team called Kano won the runner-up of Japan's national high school baseball tournament in 31. It proved that a team composed of Japanese, Han, Taiwanese, and indigenous people could at least compete with their colonizers. And later in the 70s, Taiwan won numerous so-called world champions in Little League World Series based in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, USA, and caused nationwide frenzy. Little League fever was at full throttle at that time. Taiwan won the world champion 17 times from 1969 to 1996. From the hindsight, it is kind of ludicrous to see a nation value this kid's victory so much. It's like a nationwide celebration for England's U-12 team winning U-12 World Cup, if there is such a thing. However, if you consider that Taiwan or Republic of China was kicked out of United Nations in 1971, their seats in many international sport federations were serious jeopardy. The way these victories in the Little League World Series was blown out of proportion is getting more understandable. Chiang Kai-shek and his KMT government used the victories in kids baseball to boost their national morale in that tough circumstances. So there are constant jokes about our national sport, with only the sports that win get nationwide attention. People often say that Taiwan's national game or sport is winning. It is partly true. After Taiwan's best Olympic result ever in Tokyo Olympics, being crazy about fringe sports such as women's weightlifting, judo, or taekwondo, badminton and table tennis stars also enjoy their 15 minutes of fame. So as long as they are keep winning, they will get national attention. They can enjoy their status as national sport.
Okay, thank you. I want to wrap this up with just some reflections about how athletes are contributing to debates about the future of sport in the two countries. Alan, can you comment on the UK first?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think they all contribute simply by their very presence, the symbolic role that they play as members of national teams from the various component nations. In terms of being outspoken about the future of the United Kingdom, athletes in the UK have been fairly quiet. One exception to that, of course, was when there was the referendum on Scottish independence, which was narrowly defeated. And the two sides, the people who wanted Scotland to leave the United Kingdom and the ones who wanted the country to remain, both tried to galvanize some support from athletes for their particular causes. The Remainers, the people who wanted Scotland to remain as part of the United Kingdom, were much more successful in getting high-profile athletes. And I think there's an element of pragmatism sometimes about this, because Olympic athletes in particular were very conscious of their role within the Olympic movement. The support that they received from the UK, from UK sport. And were reluctant, I think, to envisage a future in which they would be part of a much smaller Olympic team, potentially, with a lot less economic resources to back up their training regimes and expertise available to them. So someone like Sir Chris Hoy, the cyclist, one of the UK's most successful Olympians, was speaking out against independence. Sir Alex Ferguson, who's prominent part of his career, of course, was spent in England at Manchester United, again, spoke out against Scotland leaving the UK. Although in his case, more from a Labour Party perspective, I think. I mean, it wasn't pragmatism, sporting pragmatism. It was a genuine belief that the Labour Party should govern the whole of the United Kingdom. The one prominent athlete who did speak up for independence was Andy Murray. And I think his role was interesting because he plays an individual sport, of course, in tennis. He got very little help in his career from any British sporting organization. Lawn Tennis Association contributed nothing to Andy Murray's rise to degree of success on the international stage. His mother started the process and then he went to Spain. So in a sense, he was detached from UK sport. He didn't have to feel that without UK sport, he would be less successful. I'd compare him in some ways with the Chinese tennis player Li Na, when the opening up policy began for some athletes in China, the flying solo, as it was called. Because she was a tennis player, it was much more easy for her to say, as she did on one occasion, I don't do this for China, I do this for myself. And that, of course, got a stern rebuke from many people. But I think individual sports are a little bit different, that people can actually speak up because they're not so dependent upon a collective entity that is based in a particular political unit. So Murray was the one who spoke up, said on the day of the referendum, let's do it, folks. Well, I think that simply added to the slight suspicion that many English people have of Murray, but he did lead the British tennis team to success in the Davis Cup for the first time in many years. So he's done his bit for British sport, but he was the spokesman for nationalism, at least from a sporting perspective.
I feel compelled here to add that Andy Murray was selected to carry the flag at the opening ceremony of the Brazil Olympics in 2016. So it's quite interesting that he was brought back into the fold, I suppose. But these issues of sovereignty, I guess, are important in Taiwan, Sean. So how are athletes contributing to debates there?
Yeah, in 2018, Tokyo Olympics Taiwan name rectification referendum was launched. It requested to rectify the current Chinese Taipei to Taiwan. During the campaign, most Taiwanese athletes were against the referendum because they fear that the proposal itself might infuriate China or maybe the IOC about Taiwan's Olympic formula, which required Taiwanese athletes to compete under the name Chinese Taipei. Most of these athletes did not want to change the status quo. They proclaimed that there would be a chance that the IOC to suspend Taiwanese athletes from competing in the Tokyo Olympics had the referendum been passed. The referendum failed to pass by the margin 55 to 45%. The appeal by these athletes are understandable. After all, they trained and played so hard for the Olympics. Glory and fans aside, Taiwanese government also offered one of the most luxurious bonus in the world for these medal winners. Gold medalists can get 20 million NT, roughly equal to £520,000. To compare, Tom Daley got nothing from the UK government. So it is hard to blame Taiwanese athletes to be risk averse under these circumstances, as their careers and huge payout were at stake. With Chinese capital gaining the leverage in the IOC, such as Alibaba getting Olympic partner status, and the China Mengniu Dairy becoming a major sponsor, it is very daunting to challenge the status quo unless the international societies started to realize the threats China money can maybe bring them. This athlete also said that, yes, the name per se is ridiculous, but at least we let the world see and hear how ridiculous it is by participating in the games. To some extent, it might be true. If we are banned, none of the publicity would be coming. Actually, during the Tokyo Olympics, major news outlets such as Reuters, AFP, NHK, and The Guardians all ran stories on Taiwan's name game. So after the Tokyo Olympics, I don't see potential change in their stance in terms of Taiwan's future through sport. These athletes were raised in a very conservative environment to start with. To fight against the officials in their federation would be very unwise and might run the risk of being banished. Second, their chance for class upward mobility rides on the result in major international competitions, especially the Olympics. That is why there are only a few athletes supporting the referendum. They are either naturalized basketball players originally from America, or mavericks, or troublemakers in their federation's eyes. So I am pessimistic in potential name change of Taiwan in the Olympics. However, sport and these athletes do bring the nation together. That is beyond any doubt. When Taiwanese duo Li Yang and Wang Qilin beat China's opponent in the final of men's double in badminton and won gold medal, it marked the first time in the Olympic history that a Chinese athlete had to stand on the podium when the national flag anthem of Taiwan was played. There was a zenith of Taiwan's nationalist fever inspired by sport. So when Taiwanese athletes may object any substantial change on the name of the nation in the Olympics at this time, their performance on the field actually speak otherwise. Most Taiwanese dream of being known as the name we all agree on, Taiwan, that is. However, we are also realistic. Until that one bright day comes, Chinese Taipei is the hideous, ridiculous name these athletes have to bear.
Thanks, Sean. That was a really interesting answer. And I think that's a great place to leave this first of our series of podcasts about Taiwanese and UK sport. I think what we've seen there are some fascinating comparisons of sport in the two countries. There are obviously some notable differences, but there's also some really remarkable and quite unanticipated similarities in the issues facing sport in these two places. So thank you very much, and I hope people will join us for the next in our series of podcasts.